Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions in the law. My name is Matthew Kerbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Natalie Knowlton. When I interviewed Natalie, it was before she co-founded Access to Justice Ventures. However, she recently appeared on Bob Ambrosi's podcast, Law Next, where she talks about it. After you finish listening to this episode, I highly encourage you go check it out. You can find links to that interview and to Access to Justice Ventures in my show notes. 650 sponsors this podcast, which means you can get 10% off when you use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at checkout in their document marketplace. For a 650 subscription, tell them that Law Subscribed sent you during the sign-up process to get 10% off your annual subscription. For me to make a personal introduction between you and 650, click the link in the show notes called Get Connected with 650 and enter your contact information. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode.
Thank you, Natalie, for joining me on Law Subscribed. So happy to have you here. We met because I am on the Foundations for Practice Advisory Committee for IELTS, and you work at IELTS, and I reached out saying, you know, hey, IELTS is, you know, one of the most innovative things out there, organizations out there as far as changing the legal profession for the better. I have to have somebody from IELTS on the show Law Subscribed, and you came highly, highly recommended. But tell me, please, and tell our audience, you know, exactly what it is, what you do, and then maybe just give them a teaser for how that relates and dovetails into subscriptions in the law.
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Matthew. So to start, IALS, and that's IAALS, is short for the Institute for the Advancement of the American Legal System. And we're a national nonprofit located on the University of Denver campus, but we have national ties, focused on continuous improvement in civil justice. So my work in particular, my title is Director of Special Projects, which makes me very special. Always come specially recommended. But my scope of work is family justice reform, a lot of self-represented litigant issues. I work in public trust and confidence research, and I'm doing quite a bit now on the regulatory end. So IELTS also works in legal education, legal profession, civil justice reform. As I mentioned, I'm leading the family effort, and we dabble in some other areas too, but we are solely civil justice focused. And I think the reason that I'm here today is to talk about subscriptions in the context of access to justice and how these new models that we're seeing attorneys and firms implement can really scratch into some of that justice gap and start bringing on new clientele.
So tell me, when was the first time you came across the subscription model as applied to law?
Oh boy, it's one of those dates I'm not sure where I was, unlike September 11th. Let's see. I think my work in family justice very quickly transitioned to self-represented litigant issues. Back when I started working in this area, it was believed that most self-represented litigants, the high self-represented litigants rate, appeared in these family cases. And so it was at that time that I started noticing practitioners trying to reach into this segment of the market and trying to do so through primarily the monetization of legal information, and doing that through a subscription-based model that sometimes not, would lead to unbundled legal services. So that connection between limited scope representation and the subscription model is really what got me into this area.
So let's go into that a little bit more. For some attorneys, they haven't ever had to distinguish the difference between legal advice and legal information. So how would you define the difference for attorneys listening in who want to understand that separation?
Sure. It's a great question. And I am certainly not an expert in distinguishing advice and information. There's a lot of jurisprudence on that. And that's single-handedly the reason why many courts in the country won't give out any legal information, because they're scared that it's advice. But the reason I think attorneys overlook it is because they assume that people can find legal information on their own. And they assume that people are finding legal information. So what do I mean by legal information? Well, if I'm a divorce litigant in Denver, I would go online and find the forms that the Colorado court makes available. I would find information about the self-help website. I would look through the website, see what kind of information they had about how to navigate the process. That's legal information. And one court staff person who I interviewed as part of a project once said to me, it's the word should. If you put the word should into it, it becomes advice. If you leave the word should out, it's generalized information. And so attorneys, of course, aren't going to think about legal information because they're in the business of that should, that legal advice. That's what they're trained to do, and that's what their license allows them to do. But a lot of people don't know where the simple legal information exists. And that's where I think organizations like Hello Divorce and others are pulling that open source information that's on the, in Hello Divorce's case, California court website, in other jurisdictions the same. They're pulling that legal information together to create a kind of packet, create a kind of roadmap for litigants that is scalable. And scalability is one of the key things behind turning legal information into a subscription-based model, is it gets away from that one-to-one model, which so many attorneys are using now.
Right. And I think that does a really good job explaining the difference. Is legal information is, the way that I like to put it, is it is, you can Google around and search as a layperson and discover legal information that's out there. No, there's not, it's not a lawyer that's telling you, you know, do this, do that based on your situation. And so what lawyers can do, or lawyers who start companies like Hello Divorce, which is not a law firm, at least yet,
right.
They can't give legal advice, but they could help, self-represented people or people who can't otherwise afford an attorney at a billable hour rate, parse through that information that's out there. But lawyers can do this too. And they could do this maybe without forming an attorney-client relationship. Maybe they do form an attorney-client relationship, but it's limited scope representation. And so there are other ways to monetize it as an attorney, not just as a legal services company, like something like Hello Divorce Family Law. So I think you did a really good job explaining it. And really it's just, it's like, give it to me in the form of a hypothetical and don't give me your specific situation, I think, as an attorney. And this is not legal advice coming from me. There is no legal advice given on this show, but that's, I think, as the attorney where you draw the line. Don't actually tell somebody what they should or shouldn't do based on their situation. So let's see. So something about the subscription model that at least I think we talked about briefly in the pre-show, conversation that we had, was about being able to scale and being able, to help attorneys make more money, which could be seen as a attorneys, they make enough money. Do they really need to be making more money? But that's only one perspective of the legal profession, which is the reality is a lot of young lawyers have a lot of student loan debt. And these are other issues that IELTS, looks at and tries to propose solutions to. And while I don't think we're going to solve the student loan issue, student loan debt issue here, young attorneys able to launch a subscription model could potentially make more money. So how do you see them able to adapt the subscription model and make more money from your perspective?
Sure. So I'll start with the notion that lawyers making money is a bad thing, because I think that is a bad notion. Lawyers should be able to make money. Anybody should be able to desire to generate wealth through their profession. That is why most of us go into certain professions, is so we can take care of ourselves and our families. And as you said, lawyers don't actually make that much money in the bigger picture. I think there's a stigma that you go to law school and you all of a sudden come out and you're making millions of dollars a year, but that's definitely not true for the majority of attorneys that I know. And certainly if you look at the statistics, that's not true across the board either. So I think it's okay for attorneys to want to make money. And I think it's okay for attorneys to want to make more money. And I think attorneys can make more money while serving new clientele and helping people who can't afford attorneys. You touched on the scalability issue, and we just talked about that. The one-to-one model that traditional legal services are built on, which makes a lot of sense, because that's how management consulting has been until recently, and it's how other service industries work. But if you only have the hours in your day, you're only going to make so much money. You can only serve so many people also. But if you can scale your services and create one single informational packet that has key information people are not finding elsewhere, and often they are not finding that elsewhere, that allows you to put a single piece of information out, market it, and then however many people fall into that particular category of maybe needing that information may be able to find it. And so it's really passive income at that point. And the way that attorneys can do this, you know, we were talking about Hello Divorce earlier. Hello Divorce itself is a legal tech company, but of course, people who are interested in additional legal advice and legal representation can go through the firm. They can be routed through to Aaron Levine's firm. Similarly, I have a good friend here in Colorado, and she runs a criminal justice practice. She has DIY guides on her website, so clients can download them, pay a nominal fee, and get through that information. And these are for issues that her firm has deemed simple enough for many people to do it on their own, and that they don't need to call and get her representation. But they can. At the end of the day, they can download this packet and then call her and say, I need more. And so it is a feeder into additional full-scale representation or additional unbundled services representation.
Right. So right now, some of what you've been focusing in on is the monetization of legal information for attorneys on a subscription model. How do we move from the legal information side to the actual, you know, either it's limited scope or even it's full scope representation, you know, full on legal advice on a subscription basis? How do you see that, you know, working out differently in terms of pricing, in terms of retention for clients, for attorneys when they move past, or maybe legal information, it's not their thing. They don't want to, you know, it's going to be too much work for them to do that. They give legal advice. That's what they do. So how do they just skip that step and help, you know, people sign up for subscription legal services?
Sure. Well, I'm not an expert in how to get people onto those types of services, but certainly, I do think that the feeder model allows an attorney to offer that kind of legal advice on subscription in a more targeted way. Because if you have all of the preliminary information that you've already put out in a document that you've sold for $19.99 to a client, and then you offer them a subscription model where they have 10 hours of your time, your questions, and a couple documents that you offer to draft every month, then I think they're going to be able to come to you with more pinpointed questions about what to do, where to go. They're going to have more information so that you're spending less time using your hours of subscription, actually reviewing the legal information. So I think it is a really good supplement to have that. But you know, it's a game, I think, for attorneys. You certainly need to experiment with it and figure out what that perfect model is. But it's a great way to have that recurring revenue. And some clients won't need it. And some clients will, and they'll need more. And then you figure out how to build that in. But I think it allows clients a lot of freedom and flexibility to contact attorneys when they need to, but to move forward with their own issues when they don't need the attorney. And it allows attorneys flexibility because they're not constantly out trying to get clients on a case or issue by issue basis.
And a question, maybe some of the bigger firms or some firms that are too scared to move away and innovate from what I call the legacy model of law firms. Do they really have to be so worried? Because at least the access to justice side of subscriptions for law is this blue ocean of people who aren't already hiring attorneys, right? So it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be so disruptive to the legal profession when you look at it more purely from this access to justice angle. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. At least my notion is that the larger law firms certainly don't need to worry about this kind of model because they can afford not to, and their clients can afford to pay them for whatever it is they're doing with whatever model they're using. So I don't necessarily see big law coming into this at this time. But I do think that there is more opportunity for attorneys. And you note that as an attorney, you don't need to build a subscription model into your practice necessarily. You can join onto some sort of branded network that leverages subscription models if you want that kind of exposure. So these are your legal Zooms, potentially participating in a ARAG or like scheme for insurance through EAPs. I mean, there's any number of organizations that you could actually join as a consulting attorney. I don't know if that's the exact title that they would use, but you can become part of these models without actually needing to develop your own subscription model within your firm.
Yeah, and it's a great point to mention because you know, LegalZoom and those types of companies sort of get a bad rap with attorneys. They think they're taking clients away when the reality is they might be if you had a more affordable access to, you know, your legal services, but maybe you don't. Let's talk about some of the attorneys that you've that you see using the subscription model. I mean, it's still very early in, you know, there's not too many that I've come across. I maybe come across a couple dozen attorneys, and that's even doing this show and getting introduced to more attorneys who are using the subscription model. And some of them don't even know they are. Some of them are offering a flat fee per month and they don't consider that the subscription model. But in your experience, I mean, how many attorneys have you seen looking at or considering using the subscription model or just, you know, innovative billing practices that aren't a billable hour?
So many, predominantly solo and small, but lots of solos. I think when you think about in the startup realm, the scrappy startup that, you know, is changing and launching and pivoting all the time, that's your solo practitioner from my standpoint right now. There are so many solos out there trying new things, integrating new software, anything to create efficiencies, both for themselves. Sometimes they pass them on to the client. Sometimes they don't pass those efficiencies on and they continue billing at the same rate. No judgment on either front. But I really think that if, you know, states are the laboratory of experimentation and solos are the laboratory of experimentation in the law. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
And so what have you been exposed to? Because you said earlier that somebody might charge a subscription model where they get, somebody gets access to so many hours of their time a month. What are some of the other examples that you've seen attorneys offering as far as legal services or legal information on a subscription basis?
Document drafting is a big one, particularly in family law, having the initial parenting plan and the initial filings drafted, whether it's working with both parties or working with one. I haven't seen this as much in criminal, although I did mention that a friend who does some of these toolkits in criminal. I think one thing that you see in Canada, which is interesting, and I don't know that we have authorized it here, but legal coaching. In Canada, this doesn't have to be a lawyer who necessarily does it. And I'm sure lawyers, just by virtue of representation now, are doing that. But I think that there's a room for that in the U.S. as coaching as a service to help a litigant understand how to talk to a judge so the judge will listen. And we'd like to think that the judge will listen irrespective of how someone is talking, but I don't think that that's necessarily true. So coaching someone on how to act in court, on how to speak to the judge, coaching someone on strategy. I think that coaching model, a lot of attorneys are doing it, but I think it's going to become more of an actual kind of commoditized service here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if the legal coaching goes into the legal information. Like, because somebody could go for and sit in court and watch how attorneys act and watch how pro se litigants act and listen to judges and learn that on their own, as opposed to just going to an attorney or a legal coach who knows that and teaching them. And that does kind of toe the line, getting close to, you know, legal advice, I suppose. You got to be careful as an attorney in the U.S. But that makes me think of just legal consulting in general. You know, I'm an attorney who primarily practices state law. And while I know a lot about the law in the areas I practice, I have to be very careful about, you know, representation or legal advice, you know, out of, you know, my jurisdiction, or if it's, you know, involves an Illinois resident or something, and, or there's a nexus with Illinois, I could, you know, maybe still represent them as long as I, you know, do my research and I have ethical responsibilities. But, you know, is there an opportunity for me to be a legal consultant, and, you know, me or any attorney, you know, on a subscription basis to people across the U.S., you know, in my practice area? You know, the advice is always hire a lawyer when you actually need to go to court or draft a document or whatever, but there might be opportunities to expand beyond my license reach in my state to do legal coaching, legal consulting on a subscription basis and earn additional revenue in addition to my practice. I think that's a really interesting opportunity with the legal coaching. It dovetails into that. What do you think about that? Is that what you were talking about, or is that maybe a different step? What are your thoughts?
No, I think that's in line with what I was thinking of there. When I think about coaching, I do tend to think about it along that line of information and advice. So it depends on who's giving the information. But there's coaching along non-legal advice lines, like we talked about earlier. And then there's, of course, coaching done by an attorney. And I think monetizing that kind of coaching is a particularly interesting area to allow that as a service, perhaps through subscription, where An attorney can help a client understand the strategy, can help a client understand why the attorney thinks the law is on his or her side, and be able to go into court and speak for him or herself. There are any number of reasons that a client would want to speak for him or herself in court. And there's any number of reasons that a client would not want an attorney all the way through the case, monetary and particularly in family law otherwise. So if you have an attorney on the back end, outside of the view of the court, that is really helping you work through strategy, helping you understand your case, helping you understand why key things are important, then you're able to show up to court with a much better understanding of the process and information on how to get your point across. And I think that kind of model, decoupled from the full service model, decoupled from perhaps form development and filing and mediation, these other kind of services, that limited scope representation really does allow for a lot of discrete tasks to be put into a subscription model.
Yeah. And you know, we keep bringing up, you know, limited scope and being careful with legal information versus legal advice. And really what that comes down to is legal ethics, right? And so a question that we've got, and actually I interviewed an attorney who practices in Colorado and looks at the ethics of subscription. So I did talk about this with somebody, but from your perspective or from what you've learned, you know, being involved the way that you are, you know, are subscription services ethical? And we're not asking for legal advice, but you know, from what you've seen, how do you make sure that they're ethical?
Well, ethics are a stickler, of course. I think in terms of, I mean, let's look at this from the context of limited scope representation, because if you have a subscription model, then you're probably operating within that limited scope representation model. So it's critical importance that you actually talk with your client and make sure that they understand and get informed consent for the scope of the services, what you are covering and what you're not covering. And it's also important to talk to the client about what else they're expecting from it. If they're expecting you to do certain things and you know you're not going to do them, for example, in a 10-hour a month subscription model of advice and document drafting, and they think that you're going to go do an IP filing, it's important to talk about that and document that you're not going to do that. So that initial agreement between the attorney and the client, it needs to be have everything spelled out as much as possible for the expectations of both the attorney and the client. And then deviating from that model. So, okay, what if it's the 11th hour of legal advice and the client really needs to get this in because the filing is due? What does that mean for the attorney? What does that mean for the client? Does that expand the scope of representation? Do you need to document that and have the client sign another agreement letter? All of these kind of things that I think, you know, attorneys might not think of in the subscription model, but definitely should. I just think following by the best practices of limited scope representation from numerous ethics experts is probably the best approach.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for IELTS and the ABA to, you know, look into this and write about it and provide some guidance, because subscriptions are relatively new, applied to law in the way that we're trying to do it, Law Subscribed. But it, you know, it needs that guidance. And I think that'll help. And I think it helps attorneys make money. It helps people who can't otherwise afford, you know, legal services and the legacy model at the billable hour, you know, get access to attorneys and legal advice or legal information that they could better understand. And, you know, it's not going to solve the problem, but it's going to help, I think. You know, most attorneys can't afford to hire themselves at their own billable rate. And that's sort of ridiculous. So this, I think, would be a step in the right direction. Now, you've mentioned criminal law, you mentioned family law. Are there other areas of law that you've seen this attempted?
I think I've seen it in sometimes in the context of startups who need information and need advice as they're going along, but might not necessarily be ready to create a cap table yet or to patent products. So I think there's opportunity there as just kind of a sounding board for legal advice for individuals undertaking a business endeavor. I think family law is the predominant area that I see a lot of this happening. And that could be because that's my area. And so I'm focusing more often there.
So I have seen it more in family law as far as litigation related subscription services are concerned. I've seen a lot more subscription legal services as it's applied to transactional work, because it's a little bit more predictable than litigation. That being said, if you practice law long enough, or if you know about it enough, litigation can be more predictable. especially when you look at non-contested divorces, right? You know, what you need to do, it's pretty straightforward. Those are the only types of divorces I've ever done and that I ever will do as a practicing attorney. But even I imagine the contested situations, you could scope it out and get a sense of how many court appearances, how many times you're going to need to talk to the judge and get a rough estimate. And so my question for you is, somebody who is maybe just starting out or is a younger attorney and isn't able to scope that out, but they want to be innovative, they want to launch a subscription model for their family law practice that they're just starting, you know, how do they get that information? Where do they go? Like, well, who could they talk to? What could they do?
So finding others who are doing it is the best way to figure out what things look like. I don't know that there is a central repository. Twitter seems to be that central repository of attorneys and law firms doing amazing things along with legal tech, but certainly ABA, most recently, ABA, IELTS, the Chicago Bar Foundation, and the Self-Represented Litigation Network, a lot of acronyms in there. We hosted a conference directly looking at unbundled legal services, but we talked about how technology can interplay with this business model and how subscriptions can fit within this. And we developed some content that we'll be putting online soon. So looking at organizations like that who intend to put and compile information of who's doing what. But I really, sometimes if you find someone who's doing something that you think is cool, reaching out to them, seeing if you have a mutual contact on LinkedIn, seeing if you can read about the work that they've done. I know that Aaron Levine and others have done a lot of writing around the challenges of building this kind of model, particularly the challenges of building it within the bounds of the current ethics rules, and understanding what they did and what they didn't do and why, and then reaching out with targeted questions about how your business model might be different or similar to theirs and what they might be able to offer you by way of advice, I think is a great idea. I don't mean to throw Aaron a bunch of cold emails, but asking people how they did what they did is really the best way, I think.
Yeah, and I suppose hopefully Law Subscribed, it gets added to that list at some point when it comes to launching a subscription model.
Absolutely.
But I do think that the bar associations need to be better about mentorship and to be there for attorneys that want to, you know, start a practice or do something innovative, and to be able to find those other attorneys at bar associations. I think they're best situated to do that right now. So I agree with you that I think that's a great place to go. In addition, of course, to IELTS, and the Chicago Bar Foundation has actually connected me with a bunch of attorneys who are doing the subscription model across the country. So that's great. It's a great group that that you mentioned, and that you've put on some programming. So I'll definitely send that to me when it's available, and I'll make sure to promote it on our channels and link to it in the show notes for this interview.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database, since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney, or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form at scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
In addition to just the subscription being an innovative way for billing services, there's also other things you could do. You could do flat fee. You could do, other types of unbundled services, maybe at a low hourly rate. I'd like to stay away from the hourly rate, but are you seeing attorneys using flat fees in any innovative ways? And if so, how?
I see a lot of flat fees. The one thing that I would caution about flat fees is I know that a lot of attorneys base their flat fees around the hours that they would spend on the case. And conceptually, of course, that makes sense because you need a way to do that. But what that essentially does is just puts the billable hour into a different form, especially for those attorneys who are efficient at their work. I think where a lot of attorneys get in trouble with setting a flat fee that's not set around the number of hours that they spend on the issue is where they're going to spend three times the amount of hours that they normally, or not normally would, but three times the amount of hours than they budgeted. So in a way, I think flat fee is great for the client. It's great for the customer. They understand what it's going to cost. There are no hidden fees and it's a good model, but attorneys do need to price it well. And I fear that it's just a billable hour creeping up in another form in some contexts. One of the things that I love, and I haven't seen anybody doing it, but I've read some articles on it, and I think there's a big law firm out there doing it, is value-based billing, where they will tally up based on the hours they've spent and what they think their services are worth, and they have a write-in that allows the client to vary from that if they'd like. And I think there's a lot of social psychology and behavioral economics behind that kind of approach. I'm not sure that a client would ever deviate from that. But I really like the idea of opening that up to the client. If you don't think I was worth this, tell me what you think I was worth. Again, I haven't seen people doing that, but.
Well, that's a really good idea. And I want to dive into that just a little bit, because one of the issues that comes up with the subscription model, whether it's law, whether it's Netflix, Amazon, or whatever, is membership retention. Right, subscriber retention, and what's one of the reasons that you stay subscribed? You know, what if I binge watched this show that I want to watch on Netflix, or in my case Disney Plus, and then cancel my subscription after I've watched all of The Mandalorian, right? And then when the next season comes out, I'll pay for, you know, the month when it's over, and I'll do the same thing. So how do you, you know, retain your clients? And I think that's one of the ways that you could really keep them on your subscription is, you know, hey, you know, these last 3 months you only used my services in X, Y, and Z way. When you've hired me for, you know, 12 different things a month, you know, let's revisit when I'm billing you a month and what you're paying me a month, and look at, you know, a more, you know, value-based amount of the services you're actually receiving. And then they stay a client, and then they're happy because they're paying less because they're getting less, but then they stay a client. And when they need more, you do it again and you sign up more. So value-based billing, I think, is a really interesting way to solve one of the aspects of solving that retention problem. What do you think?
Yes, I think you raise an interesting point. And this is a particular the problem in B2C firms that are looking at subscription models is your average consumer, as opposed to what people might call the more sophisticated consumers, business consumers. The average consumer doesn't necessarily think about the lawyer all the time. That might shock some people or not. But a divorce doesn't last forever. A probate case doesn't last forever. And so you do have people in the Netflix example who are signing up for these subscriptions through the duration of their issue. And then once the issue ends, then they're gone. And that makes complete sense. Why would someone hang along for additional divorce resources when they're past their divorce? But this is where I think attorneys can get really creative. And this is especially where the preventative lawyering movement comes in. And this is a lot of education to consumers and the average Joe, if you will, average Jane, about what the law encompasses and what could be a potential legal issue. For example, I moved recently. I moved homes. And this could be an opportunity where I'd sit down with a lawyer and say, okay, what are some of the implications? Well, did you remember to change your insurance over? Well, what about in your jurisdiction now you have this kind of requirement for a new roof, and that's a legal issue that came out recently, and is your roof compliant with that? Things like that. It really does require attorneys to think preventatively, and I at least was not taught in law school to think preventatively. We were always taught to think, go into action once something has happened. But it's a big field. It's a big opportunity if lawyers can start getting around this idea of what kind of value can I add to clients in the course of their daily life, and how do I communicate that to them so that they know that I can add value at these times.
Excellent, and I haven't heard it phrased like that. Preventative lawyering movement, is that what you said? Right.
Yes.
And like I think of it in terms like litigation avoidance, like, or like, you know, proactive lawyering, right? Where on the subscription model, they're paying you. So they're going to call you for issues. And then you as their attorney can help them avoid, you know, situations like not being compliant with the roof, or, you know, somebody didn't, you know, do the job they said they were going to do, but you paid them to do something at your house. And instead of having to, you know, sue over it, they're, you know, or, you know, there's other issues that may arise, and then they could call their lawyer who they're already paying. So it's almost like it helps with issue spotting. Cause right now it's, how do I know I need a lawyer? Well, there's a billboard that says, you know, do you have lung cancer? hire us, you know? So lawyers have to do the issue spotting for their clients, but if they're already paying to call and talk to them, they could do the issue spotting, which could lead to litigation avoidance, which goes back into the access to justice issues of courts being backlogged and overloaded. And if attorneys are helping more people at a lower cost in the subscription model, then maybe the courts won't be so backlogged with so many issues. So yeah, preventative lawyering. I like it. I'm going to use it. And I definitely think that plays a big role in what the subscription model can do for lawyers and for society.
Absolutely. I don't know, just if I can offer a personal example. So I lost my mother earlier this year, and I am the only child, single heir. So it's not really a complicated affair. I'm an attorney. I don't do probate law, never have, but I thought this would be simple enough to figure out, and it doesn't seem to be that much to do, but there actually is something to do. And fortunately, I have a subscription model in the sense that my father is a lawyer who's worked on probate cases. So he was able to help me through that. But the average person, the average only child who loses a parent, who doesn't have debt, who doesn't have a lot of assets to worry about, who doesn't have creditors, that person could call that subscription, their attorney under a subscription model, and say, wow, what should I expect here? Because I found out what to expect by virtue of someone telling me and by it happening. And when it happens, you'd really prefer to have that kind of heads up in advance.
Absolutely. And I'm so sorry for your loss.
Appreciate it.
So in terms of how to bill, one of the ways that's being looked at is different tiers, right? So like right now, you know, if you look at a comparative model, Netflix offers different levels for what kind of definition you want. Like, do you want standard definition? Do you want high definition? For Amazon Prime, they just say, no, we're going to keep it simple. This is the one number. This is what we're charging. And that's it. Have you, you know, in your opinion, and what have you seen, you know, how should attorneys approach, you know, tiered billing, if that's even something that they should consider, or should they just have a one price? This is it. Take it if it works for you, or leave it.
I think tiered billing makes sense from the context of you're increasing the either number of hours or number of documents you prepare. You're some sort of rationing up the work that you're going to do. It's hard. The HD and SD context, that's very interesting, because I don't think that an attorney legally and ethically could offer the standard definition versus the high definition in terms of quality. But certainly, I think time spent and the number of things that you generate, and those are not necessarily the same. You can generate documents very quickly, and that doesn't necessarily equate to a lot of time. So rather than the number of hours, what are the outputs, and what does that look like from the client's perspective? I think you might be able to do tiered services there. And then these information models that I was talking about earlier, those absolutely allow for a tiered service. So for example, you have tier one, which is completely DIY. Just dive into all of these articles that I have online about legal information, divorce, how to do this. You're on your own. You know, good luck. The second tier, okay, we understand you might need some help with forms. So dive into all this information. Do it yourself. We'll be here to answer a phone call about the forms, and we'll give you 1 hour to walk through it. And then the next model would be, for example, here's all this information. We're here with you for 5 to 10 hours. You call us when you need us at certain stages, and we're going to just work for you on whatever you think is important. And that is a tiered model that I think would work.
Right. And implicit in your description is that with each additional level that somebody, you know, pays for, is presumptively more money for the additional services, and also inclusive of the lower level services. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
So as far as the lowest tier, whether it's just DIY, or I've seen things where you could call an attorney for 15 minutes a month, you know, for $10 a month, I think Law on Call, I don't know if that's the exact amount or if that's the name of the company that's doing it. They're one of these new innovative, they're not a law firm in Arizona or Utah. I can't recall which state right now. What would you think is the right price for that? However, you know, somebody structures it DIY only, 15 minute call a month or something else. What's the lowest a lawyer could and should go?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have the expertise to necessarily answer that. I don't have expertise in billing.
Just your opinion. Just in your opinion. You're knowledgeable. You care.
I do have opinions.
Yeah.
Okay. So in my opinion, I think one of the things that gets attorneys in trouble or gets the client in trouble, if you will, is that attorneys price their services based on what other attorneys are pricing their services at. And I think attorneys, especially now who are working virtually, who are increasingly understanding how to reach clients where they are, which is often not on the doorstep of their law office, those attorneys are really creating some inefficiencies that allow them to do some undercut pricing. And by that, I mean undercutting the traditional market that they're in. So I think it's a really individual assessment. Every attorney has to take into account what their bottom line is at the end of the month, what they want to be making, all the expenses that go into that. But if you reduce those other expenses in a way that's meaningful to you, but allows you to serve clients in the same manner, then I think you really can price below the traditional market. And that's where I think you start getting in and building a clientele. And that then allows you to price up to the current market in some aspects once you gather that clientele and that word of mouth that goes around.
Do you have any ideas other than that value-based billing that we discussed of ways that attorneys can incentivize that their subscription clients stay subscribed? You know, I do the level one DIY stuff. I figure it out. You know, I take care of it and then I'm done. You know, you discussed the value in staying subscribed with the personal example you gave with probate. But other than just waiting around for something like that to happen, is there anything that you could think of that would help that attorneys can use to help keep, everyday people subscribed to their subscription model?
Well, I'm going to make a plug for legal regulation changes here, because I think partnerships are crucial when it comes to providing services to clients and certainly to providing continuing services to clients. Not everything has roots in law, right? We know that. But so much of law has roots in problems that people can benefit with other professions. And I didn't phrase that well. But what I mean is a client going through a divorce, for example, is only going to need the attorney until the end of the divorce, assuming that there are no post-decree issues. But that client might need mental health care. They might need financial consulting and advising in this single parent household. They might need any sort of other services, professional services that the attorneys can connect them to and work with them with. And that's where the regulation changes come in. If we do allow non-attorney ownership in law firms, then what we're looking at are potential service opportunities that are holistic, that serve clients at all levels of their life, that when the legal problems fade away, then we're looking at other issues that firm can provide them services in. And so I think also that what that does is it creates this notion, which clients know all too well and attorneys don't often think about, is that a legal problem is a problem. And we have a lot of other problems when we're dealing with legal issues. Probate, think about all the problems that you have emotionally in probate when you lose someone. So if you allow attorneys to partner in a meaningful way, and meaningful, I mean also in a way that allows everybody to make money off that partnership, then I think you're really in business to subscription models that can serve people at any point in their life.
I agree. So diving back into the, for one last time, the access to justice issue in the forefront. But one of my guests, Ruben Metcalf, who I think you may be acquainted with as well, has proposed an idea that you can take whatever the bare minimum access to an attorney is, and at the lowest viable price, and just for the thought experiment's sake, $20 a month to be able to call an attorney for 15 minutes a month, and make it a public service, where it's something that whether everyone contributes or you could opt in on your taxes or something, you know, where it's like a tax-free $20 that you pay, you know, every month ahead of time at the end of the year, you know, without going into too much of the minutiae of it, make it a thing where attorneys can, like, I could sign up to be in that program, and then I'm getting paid from the government to provide this public service at a very low amount. But then I don't have to go out, I don't have to get 250 clients at $20 a month every month, which would be about 60 grand a year. And the government gives them to me, and then I can provide that service. It's an interesting idea. It was an on-the-fly idea. You know, there's a lot to work out, but what do you think about something like that? Even if it's not that specific hypothetical, is that something that's viable? Is that something that we should look at as a society?
I don't know. And I say that because anybody who follows me knows that I've been pretty vocal about the pro bono legal aid issue. I think we wouldn't be where we are without legal aid and pro bono. But in terms of are they a scalable solution to our justice crisis, to the extent that they rely on government funding, which relies on taxpayer money, I don't know that they're sustainable. They're sustainable at their current levels, certainly, at least we hope so. But should we be expecting taxpayers to fork over another $1 billion in the decades to come for legal services? I don't think so. I don't think that's a compelling ask to taxpayers. I think it should be, but if you just look at taxpayer priority, I don't think it would be. I could be wrong, and I hope someone proves me wrong because I'd love to see that data. But I think the idea of offering a phone call to a lawyer for $20, I think is fantastic. Is that going to be subsidized? I don't know that that's scalable. But the thing about pricing is a lawyer has to take into account what they're doing in that 15 or 20 minutes that might be worth more than $20. And if they're not doing anything, or if they can scale that model, then I absolutely think that that kind of pricing scheme and model should thrive. It all depends on really what, you know, the consumers want. But I do think that for many legal services, we're going to have to assume that consumers are going to need to pay something.
Right. And, you know, Ruben's a big thinker, and he thinks, you know, nationwide, worldwide, but it would also be interesting to see it done in a very local level, like local government or even state government, and see something, you know, try something out like that and see how it works and see if it leads to litigation avoidance and leads to the courts being less backlogged, because then it ends up saving a lot more money if somebody could call an attorney and avoid, you know, a bad situation that would end up in court. So, I'm like you, I'm unsure. It's an interesting idea. There's a lot to be worked out. And I really hope I get someone from like Legal Services Corporation on the show to dive deep on that and see what they think about it. But because of you know, the access to justice angle that you take at it, I really wanted to get your input on it. So I appreciate that. I'm also not sure. The last question I have for you is, as it relates to recent ABA data from the profession from 2021, it shows that, again, what I'm calling the legacy model of law just is failing women. It's failing attorneys of color. Women are now going to law school more than men, but they're still, you know, less than 20% of leadership in law firms, even less for attorneys of color. So I look at the subscription model as potentially a way for women attorneys of color to be able to scale their practice, earn a really good living, and do something good in ways that they can never have accomplished at large law firms or legacy model law firms. And that being said, the system is broken and it shouldn't be for these for women and attorneys of color. But I've talked to more women who are doing stuff with the subscription model than any other attorney from any other background, and they're having great success. And so I wonder if the subscription model is going to be an avenue for attorneys that the legacy model hasn't worked for them to go and launch their own practice, small, medium, maybe, you know, they grow it in the future. And that's what we're going to see. We're going to see attorneys that frankly look like me, stick with the legacy model that has worked for them, because why not? And then we're going to see a lot of innovation from attorneys that don't look like me. Do you think that I'm thinking too much of the subscription model and what it could do for women attorneys and attorneys of color, or do you see that opportunity there?
Well, I think I see the bigger picture broadly, and I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's awful that women of color are leaving big law in droves and choosing not to go in that, because it's such a broken model. And I think that's terrible in the sense that certainly the people who are leading big law are not going to be the ones who can change big law, or else they would have done so by now. So to the extent that we have leaders who are women and people of color leaving, I think that really puts up a big obstacle to big law finally changing. But I think in terms of people opening up their own practice, I mean, that probably is the way that you get wealth and freedom, is running your own business and doing that yourself and getting out from the bounds of traditional law. I think in terms of hourly billing versus the subscription model, that, you know, really does depend on what kind of cases or clients a particular attorney is serving. But I do think that women who are leaving big law to open their own practice are certainly looking at innovations that they weren't able to implement in that big law structure that can assist both their personal and professional life. Because everybody, men, women, and anybody is looking to benefit both personal and professional through what they do day to day. So I do think it's an opportunity for innovation.
My actual last question for you is a hot dog a sandwich?
I've talked about this. I have talked about this. It is not a sandwich. I do not believe it is a sandwich because the bun and the meat are disproportionate. I don't like sandwiches that have a lot of meat hanging out. And generally, when I look at that, it suggests to me it's not. So for me, a hot dog is a hot dog. It is not a sandwich.
Thank you. And Natalie, thank you so much for being on the show. If any of the listeners want to reach out to you, we'll, of course, include all the links in the show notes. But where can they find you and reach out to you?
I am commonly found on Twitter at Natal Alleycat. That's NatalAlleyCat.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate what you're doing here.
Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for sponsoring this show. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with someone you think would find a value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kerbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kerbis with Law Subscribed.